Welcome to the Good Atheist Podcast. My name is Jacob Forte. Today I have another special guest because I've somehow been managing to pull off interviews with people. I guess my site must look good now, or maybe I'm getting a little bit more famous. Famous enough that I had a fan who let me know about this one band. He's like, you've got to get these guys on the show. Their story themselves is going to be interesting enough. And plus, their music could be very appealing to my fan base. So intrigued, checked out a band called Quiet Company. And liked the music so much, I'm like, all right, this guy's right. I need to get this guy on before he becomes too famous to come on the show. And that's probably just going to happen. And right now I have frontman, who's essentially the band, although, I mean, I suppose membership sometimes fluctuates. But Taylor Muse, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me, man.
Now, give me a little bit of an impression here. I mean, your story is a little bit complicated because it gets convoluted first and foremost in the news, right? Some people have called Quiet Company originally a Christian band, but
right.
That's not what you guys were, right?
No, we never were a Christian band. I was a Christian and I wrote songs about my life, so naturally those things kind of made an appearance in the songwriting. And plus, I always kind of had a penchant for religious imagery, maybe just because I was like raised around it and comfortable with it. And
well, you have to do something with it, right? Like if you love Jesus and you and you're a Christian, you better fucking like all the stuff about it, or else what are you left with, right?
Right. Yeah. And we did things like played Cornerstone Festival, which is the big Christian music festival in Illinois, and we were on a label called Northern Records, which was not a Christian label in the sense that you couldn't say fuck on your record if you really wanted to, but they certainly leaned that way and had predominantly Christian artists. Like Kevin Max was on the label from DC Talk. So we did things like that where people, I think, were inclined to assume that we were a Christian band.
But you did, skirt that line a little bit,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
I mean, it's inevitable just because, truthfully, I don't know if you agree with me here, but like, there's quite a bit of bad music, so anybody who can come around and actually be half decent is going to get picked up. I mean, and it's going to be a scene that's very supportive. I mean, they tend to just buy a lot of your stuff.
In Christian music?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that Christians are really good at feeding their own culture.
Oh, they definitely are. Well, I think, from what I can tell, they've gotten less concerned with that. I mean, I feel like when I was young and in high school and not really allowed to buy secular music and kind of dependent on the music that I could find at my local Bible bookstore. It was very much that way. Like it was this bubble and the bubble fed itself, you know.
Was it like lucrative? Like even in that small bubble, even just starting out?
Oh, I think so. I mean, not for me, I was young, but I definitely think that if you were a certain kind of band, you could play these churches and you'd have these built-in audiences that were huge and would come out and buy a ton of merch. You know, my church that I grew up in certainly brought in a number of bands that were cool and hip, and they'd promote the crap out of it in town, and there'd be a ton of people there and they'd sell a ton of merch. And so, you know, I wasn't really thinking about those things back then, but now that I kind of make my living doing this, like I think back on those things and like, Jesus, those people made a ton of money.
Or even maybe took that early audience for granted, right, in a sense.
Oh, I think so. I think so, too. The bands that, like, I'm still friends with several bands from that time and that scene that I kind of worshipped then and still adore today. And to talk to them, it's like they all kind of, well, not all of them, but certainly a lot of them kind of resented the scene that they were a part of in a sense that, you know, because they just kind of felt like they didn't necessarily like choose to be just this Christian band. That was just kind of the choices that ended up being laid before them. So you take the best options you were given. But they just kind of wanted to make good music.
But you skirt with that line, right? And inevitably, there's going to be some advantages. Number one, you're going to get larger audiences, probably a lot more press. But the
Definitely.
Flip side is now you're going to be painted in that corner. I mean, even like I said, most of the interviews, I think except for one, which was the Austin Chronicle, which I got to say is probably the best interview they did of you, if half the shit about it is true, because there was still a lot of really, it was disappointing, in my opinion, just the kind of coverage. I'm not used to studying music, You know, I interview intellectuals. They're easy to fucking research. They put their shit all over the place, right?
Right, right, yeah.
But musicians, I have to try to play the interpretive game. I'm trying to listen to your lyrics, and I'm like, oh, man, I'm going to make all these wild assumptions because little old me knows fucking jack shit about music.
Sure.
So it's a little bit hard to kind of get information about you.
Well, what's one good thing about this record is there's very little metaphor on this recent one, you know? It's pretty much all laid out.
This is your We Are All Where We Belong album, right? This is your most recent one. It came, because I remember even some of the interviews that I was reading. As of October of 2011, were you still a believer then? What was your mindset? Because there was plenty of talk about your older albums, and they seem to be very still full of that imagery, which is what is so different about this new one.
I think if you look at we've got three full-length records and an EP, and I think if you look at the full lengths, you can kind of see a progression. Like, certainly on the first one that we released on Northern Records, the person writing that record is very much a Christian still, but generally, like, it's far past the honeymoon period with that theology. If I'm talking about religion at all, like, it's more of a critical, like, kind of draped in metaphor, still kind of doubting, questioning type thing, but still from the perspective of someone who does cling to these beliefs.
Well, this actually leads me to this one question that's burning on my mind, because it seems as though a lot of the bandmates that play with you, people that are often sort of like cycling, are they still believers?
No, nobody is a believer. I mean, several of us, we all kind of have pretty different backgrounds with that. Jeff, our drummer, and I probably have the most similar backstories in that we were like raised in the church. We started playing music in the church. We both played in Christian bands for like a long time, and played in those bands that kind of skirted the line between Christian and secular. And just eventually, by the time we started playing together, if you asked Jeff at the last time we talked about it, he was like, just for lack of a better term, I guess I would be a deist. But, you know, so that's kind of where he is. But he's certainly not in the fold of traditional belief.
He's like a Spinozan, right? Kind of a
yeah,
thing?
Sure.
Yeah,
sure. But the rest of us are, the guys are just kind of people who, it just never mattered to them. You know, like they maybe, like Matt, I think, played in the church when he was young. I think his parents are pretty fundamentalist. But, like, from a young age, like, it just didn't matter to him and never started or, you know, never started mattering any more or less. And Cody, I think, is the same way. And Tommy went to Catholic school, but that's about as far as it went for him. Like, he just always kind of thought it was absurd.
It seemed from the interview that someone had called you the heathen. I think it was another bandmate. I'm like, maybe that's their own internal joke, although this might just be legit, you know?
Yeah. No, I'm just the most vocal.
I have this one question about your music that actually, okay, this is one of those, remember how I was trying to say, I'm trying to empathize here and trying to understand, because when I was listening to at least this new album, because there is a link that someone sent me to your live performance. It was like your whole show. And the first thing I noticed was just how energetic the whole thing is, because I remember some of the older videos that I'd seen was more like kind of happy go lucky, it seemed almost. Like, especially the stop motion animation one that you had put. I don't quite remember the name of that one.
Yeah, that's still my favorite thing.
Well, it'll be in the notes. I think everybody should still take a look at the video because it's quite amusing.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't know what we were doing when we did it. We just kind of thought this should work if we do it this way.
Oh, it totally works.
Like, you watch, if anyone who like knows how to actually do that medium will look at it and be like, what a piece of shit. But it was really fun for us. So.
I don't think anybody would look. Only the harshest cynic. For me, yeah. You know what? It isn't about, oh, look, they were using they weren't using a super high quality camera when they did this, blah.
No, certainly will not. We're not. Yeah.
You had enough views that, trust me, you hit the right chord with people. And I'm sure that it could still get a lot more. I mean, one of the things that I find depressing about a lot of videos is just they're not fun. They're just sort of like glory shots for the band and be like, look how sexy these bitches are, and you're just like, I don't care. I'm not a 16-year-old girl. Like, I don't care.
I kind of hate that too. I'm always wishing our videos were a lot funnier than they were.
Well, it is a lot of work, and as you said, it sounds like you're not entirely confident about the end product, even though I think you did just
like,
fine.
Like I think it's that one is still my favorite one that we have, just because it was, you know, like, we did it on our own. It was really fun. We didn't really know what we were doing. We just kind of went in. We're like, well, we're just going to do it anyway, you know, and did it. So that one, I think, is the one I'm the most happy with, even though the other ones are by far quality-wise way better.
But look at the contrast. You've got this sort of like happy-go-lucky one.
Right.
And you have this other one that's sort of like, you'll either have a song that is just from the get-go intense. I think that the first song you played in your set was just like, all right, hold on to your socks, kiddies. I'm coming to you at 500 miles an hour. And I have no complaints about this. I'm like, I think that's what I like about your album. I like the energy of it. But at the same time, I've been reading that apparently some of your old Christian fans are like worried about you because of the intensity of your music, perhaps. This is what I might be saying is like, you know, perhaps they feel as though your newfound realization creates a kind of manic intensity.
No, I think our live show hasn't changed much over the years, really. I mean, it has in the sense that, like, we've got more members now. Like, we are just hopefully, I think, just better at playing music than we used to be. But, I mean, as far as, like, we've always really kind of strived to have a really energetic, intense, you know, live show and fun. You know, we always want it to be fun, but the new record certainly lends itself more to like epic, just really bombastic type of dynamics for the live show than the old records did a little bit, for sure.
Well, let's just say that also watching you, I felt like at times you were channeling Buddy Holly if Buddy Holly was on crystal meth. Like, there's a lot of movement going on,
we don't know for sure that he wasn't.
That is very true. And, you know, he was such a young man when he died that he could have just gotten into all kinds of crazy shit. I mean,
yeah,
like,
I'm going to go ahead and go on the record and say that I'm 100% sure that he was on crystal meth.
You're going to go on record. Yeah, it's a good thing that so few people listen to my show that record is insignificant. I had another question in regards to that fun song that I wanted to go back to. And please correct me if I'm wrong, but I swear to God, when I was listening to that song, I thought it was Bon Jovi's Bed of Roses sped up. Is there any influence there whatsoever? Because I swear to you, I could sync the two.
Please don't say that to me.
Oh, no, I've just poisoned myself. He's going to hate me now forever.
let's just move on and pretend that statement was never made.
I want to talk to you about this one character, this writer, that apparently led largely, it seems, to your epiphany, which is Kurt Vonnegut. And every interview, he comes up. Someone's talking about him, but, you know, it's always scratching the surface, never really talking about, number one, why it was so influential, and two, I mean, we could even talk as much as you want about what was it about Slaughterhouse-Five that blew your mind, Taylor?
Man, have you read it? It's so goddamn good.
It's a bit silly at times. Those aliens that look like plungers with a glove on his head, that's silly to me. That's silly. It's not silly to you?
No, it's kind of awesome too. I'd never heard of Kurt Vonnegut, and I moved to Nashville in 2002 to kind of get away from a girl that I'd broken up with, and you know, I was just kind of sad in a way that I'd never been sad before, and just kind of saw it as this opportunity. I moved up there with a band that I was in at the time, because we had had some friends that moved up there and had kind of found some really fast success, and we just thought, well, we'll just move up there and it'll be the same for us. And we get up there, and I just decided it was a time to like reinvent myself and be whoever I decided I just wanted to be. And one of the things I wanted to be was just someone who read a lot. And so I just started reading a lot, and I had read a lot of Chuck Palahniuk, and I'd read like three of his books in a row, and kind of felt like, man, I'm in this really dark spot now after reading that guy's stuff. I need something different. And I went to the bookstore, and one of the guys there was like, well, if you like Palahniuk, then you'll really like Vonnegut. And I just kind of bought Slaughterhouse-Five to, like, appease the guy, because as he was telling me what these books were about, I'm like, man, these don't sound interesting at all. Which is kind of a unique thing about Vonnegut, is if you just sit there and talk about the plots to his books, like, they do sound absurd and, like, not interesting and boring. And, like, why would anyone write a book about that? There's nothing to that, you know? But he has such character in his voice, just the way he writes, that he could fucking rewrite the phone book, and I found, like, I would at least find it entertaining.
Well, that's exactly it. I think that he's not great with plot. He's just great with ideas. He uses the plots as a sort of, like, as a convenience for the ideas that he's trying to put up forward, which are very weird and strange.
Yeah, but I'd never really known what it's like to have, like, a favorite author before that, but I bought Slaughterhouse-Five because it seemed like, you know, at least there were, like, aliens involved and war and stuff, so I was like, that's remotely interesting, and bought it to kind of appease the guy, like I said, and eventually got around to reading it, and I just thought, this guy is hilarious. Like, he is just, like, the funniest book I've ever read. And didn't think a whole lot about it past that, other than the fact that I just thought it was really funny and good, and started reading, you know, more and more of his stuff, and just thought it was all, like, so funny. And, like, obviously, like, I'd kind of grown up in this fundamentalist Southern Baptist home, and so, like, the word humanism and just the way he talked about God so flippantly and whatnot was
almost shocking.
Kind of shocking, yeah, but it kind of been like a really, like, I don't know what the word is, but it just kind of, like, lit a fire a little bit.
Did it speak to some part of your mind that you'd never thought existed almost, or perhaps you had hinted about?
Yeah, I think it kind of, like, I'd always had doubts, you know, and I think that the way he kind of wrote about it, and kind of irreverently and flippantly, but, like, good-naturedly at the same time, I just think it kind of, like, was an invitation to me to question things that I had never questioned before, which very
enlightening,
I
suppose.
Yeah, sure. It was just so good. But what's funny about Slaughterhouse-Five to me is that years later I was living in Austin, and I was rereading it again, and I was reading it at work. I was working at Petco, and I was reading it at the cash register, and somebody came up and was talking to me about it, and was like, oh yeah, I love Slaughterhouse-Five, and it's so sad. And I was like, really? You think it's sad? And he was like, yeah, it's like this one of the saddest books ever. And I was like, that's so weird. I've just never thought of it that way. I just thought it was so funny. And but then when I went back and reread it, I'm like, man, it is pretty fucking sad.
Well, there is the bombing of Dresden, which
yeah,
is the
I mean,
reason
it's all
why
these
he
terrible
wrote it.
Things, which, yeah, I mean, it wasn't lost on me that he was writing about these really dark things, but I mean, it was just so funny, and just the way he wrote is, I don't know. It just was kind of funny to me that I was like, oh, it is really sad.
I think it speaks to your character, though. I mean, if I was to make any assumption based on your music, is that you seem like a pretty happy guy.
Yeah.
And I have seen pictures of your wife, who looks exactly like Winona Ryder.
Yeah,
and apparently she's Canadian, too, which means she's cool.
She's very cool. And she gets that all the time, yeah.
Spitting image, but still Winona Ryder before she went crazy and, you know, lost all of those hot points. We're just, really? Winona, why are you so crazy, girl?
Yeah.
So you've got a beautiful daughter.
Yeah,
so I mean, you seem like, I mean, all in all, you're not a country singer writing about horrible things here. You seem to have at least a positive outlook, even when you were at least the religious imagery you were using was still kind of like you weren't using the harsh shit. You weren't using like Abraham about to sacrifice his son kind of imagery.
No. I definitely think I'm a very positive person. I don't have anything to really complain about. Like I said, I have a beautiful wife and daughter who I, you know, love more than anything, and, you know, food in my belly. And
you've been getting more and more successful. I mean, one of the things I actually wanted to ask you is, because you had such a significant Christian base, when that started to change, was there a kind of fear that perhaps you were just like, I can't even, I mean, am I starting over? I mean, like, they still represented, like, a significant portion, or did you not care at that point? Or were you just like,
well,
I need to do this?
All those things are true. Like, when I was starting to write the record, which was, I don't know, probably like 2 or 3 years ago now, and it was when we were about to have our kid. And that's kind of what ended up being the catalyst for me to kind of just accept the fact that I wasn't the person who I always kind of wanted to believe that I was in regards to faith, and that my identity was so wrapped up in this belief system that I didn't really feel like I believed. And but when we were about to have Harper, it just kind of made me realize, like, I'm not going to lie to my child, so it's time to come clean with everyone. And I came home. I don't remember what had happened that day or whatever that kind of made me think that today was the day to come out. But, like, I, you know, came home to my wife and told her, like, hey, I don't think I believe this stuff anymore. And that's weird, but that's true. I just can't make a case for it that would convince myself, so I don't have any business professing it to anyone else.
And what was her thought about that, by the way? What was her belief system? I mean, she's Canadian, so I'm usually assuming it doesn't matter to her.
Her family is Jewish, so she was, like, kind of raised Jewish and when she was very young, but they kind of very quickly stopped caring, I think, as they got older, and it just never meant anything to her. And she,
it's a Canadian thing.
Yeah, I think maybe so. She had become a Christian early in our relationship because it was, she thought it was important to me then, even though I told her, like, it really doesn't matter to me. Like, it's not going to change how I feel about you in any way.
It's kind of sweet in a way, though.
Yeah, it was very nice. You know, she thought it would kind of grease the wheels with my family and stuff. And so she gave it the old college try, but she never really cared about it. And I never thought that she really cared about it or was convinced. So when I came home and told her that, she was just kind of like, oh, that's great, because I would have been pretending really for your sake. And I'm like, I knew that's how you were. I don't know why you bother, you know, it didn't matter to me.
It's just because she cared about you. It's obvious.
Yeah.
And it's such a sensitive issue. Like, what are you supposed to really do, right?
Totally. Yeah, I mean, and I guess I do appreciate that she, like, went through the motions for 6 years of our relationship, however long it was. But, yeah, it was kind of needless on her part. But, you know, kudos either way. So I told her, and, you know, I had begun, my parents found out that I was moving away from it, and they'd been kind of nervous about it for a while, because I would always say things about, they would always be telling me, like, oh, you need to go to church, and what are you going to do when Harper, you know, is born, what church are you going to take her to? And I was telling them, I'm probably just not going to take her. And because it's a slow process to, like, lose your faith and change your mind about something that had been such a integral part of your personality. So it had been years and years coming on. I don't think anyone was, like, terribly shocked when I said, oh, yeah, by the way, I'm not part of your club anymore. But they certainly were hurt by it all the same.
Does that still affect your relationship with them now, though? I mean, not sharing something is important. And, I mean, I don't know what type of Christianity they believe, but, you know, there's that whole burning in hell thing.
Yeah, they're definitely concerned about that. And believing what they believe, you know, their concern is totally rational and sweet. You know, it's like, it's not like they believe I'm going to hell because they want me to go to hell or anything like that. It's like they're really good, sweet people who just have the unfortunate consequence of believing the things they were taught.
And there's so little that you can change to do that, right? It's like, what can you do, right?
You can't rationalize someone out of a position that they weren't rationalized into. I wouldn't say you can't, but it's very difficult to do. So I just kind of don't try anymore. And I think that's best for everyone. Because when I first came out or whatever, my brother is a youth minister, you know, and my parents are very religious. And so they were very hurt by it and went into a kind of a knee-jerk, we've got to get Taylor back in the fold reaction, where they were constantly sending me, you know, blogs I should read or videos I should watch, books I should read. And, you know, it was never convincing in any way, but I would have sent them back rebuttals. And it was just this really passive aggressive, mind numbing, tedious experience that I'm glad is over.
It is the experience of most people going through exactly what you're going through. It's just like, well, you don't just easily say to everyone, I'm an atheist, see you later.
No, and I kind of convinced myself that, oh, this will be great, because I've been censoring myself around them for so long and not letting on that I don't believe the way they believe for so long, that now I'll be able to just tell them the truth, and the truth will set me free, as the old idiom goes, and we'll all get to be closer because of it eventually. Even though, like, I know it will upset them at first, we'll eventually be closer and feel like we really know each other better, how families should really be, and yada yada yada. And that's
right, like one of those Church of Latter-day Saints commercials. It's a total bullshit
lie. It was a terrible idea on my part, and I should have known better. But that was my...
It came from such a nice place, yeah. though. Yeah, that's always the best intentions.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we're fine. They're good people. Like I said, they're not the kind of people that disown you because they disagree with you or anything terrible like that. They still love me, and they still want me around as much as possible and just adore my daughter. And I don't resent them for anything they had done in the process of being shocked by my decision.
But you must, of course, admit that you were one of the lucky ones, though, right? I mean, that's so much as obvious.
Yeah, I mean, there's tons of horror stories out there. So I always cherish the fact that in my family, like, we'd rather be together than right.
I think that's the one thing that always shocks me when you see commercials. I don't know if you saw this. There was a commercial where it's this one woman where she's like, I didn't vote for Obama's gay marriage. That's not the change I wanted. And you just, you know, you're scratching your head and you're just like, do you realize the hurtful things that you're just doing right now? Are you going to be proud in 10 years that you got paid a few hundred dollars to be in that?
Well, dude, we just had Chick-fil-A Appreciation Day down here.
Oh.
Where people came out in record-breaking numbers to eat a chicken sandwich just so that their neighbors would know that they don't think they're the same quality of person that they are.
They don't deserve the same rights.
Right now is election season, and I'm not sure how much of it you guys have to deal with in Canada, you know, just being our neighbors or not.
85% of my audience is American. Most of the people who listen to my show confuse me as American, and you know what? It's where all my money comes from, so I am so beholden to it that I have no choice. My interest is invested in you guys, so it affects me just as much as it affects you.
Sure, sure. Yeah, it's just really absurd, man.
It's terrifying.
I don't know. Yeah, just that whole Chick-fil-A sandwich thing was just the most... Social conservatives are just... They seem to be on a mission to convince me that there's not a point that they can't miss. They just get everything wrong on social issues all the time. And I just... That party is becoming so extreme to the right, you know, that I feel like they just had their convention, you know? And to my knowledge, I didn't watch it, but... To my knowledge, I don't know that they had any, like, former presidents speaking.
No, they didn't, in fact. George Bush was absent. Yeah. He never existed.
Yeah, so, which leads me to kind of think that, you know, even George W. Bush is like, no, you guys are fucking crazy.
No, it's not that George Bush thinks that. Do you want to know why they didn't invite George Bush to the Republican convention?
What?
It's because the Republicans are now trying to craft a reality that doesn't exist. An America that never was. And to do that,
yeah,
you must ignore the man who destroyed this, even this false image you're trying to create, because no one at that whole convention was obsessed with reality. Because one of the lessons that they've learned, and this is what happens with all very far right rhetoric, is that you can make your own truth, you know. And this is, I don't know if you've read George Orwell. I certainly hope that he was on your list of authors.
Animal Farm is one of my favorites.
Well, but I'm referring more to 1984, you know, peace is war.
I actually have never got around to reading.
Oh, no. Okay,
no,
all right.
It's
You've got homework now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sending this to you at the end of our conversation. You have an e-reader? I'm assuming you do.
Yeah. I opted out of AP English in ninth grade, so I didn't have to do that.
I'm going to send that to you immediately, because there's one thing about it that when you read that, actually, I'm almost afraid, because you're going to see the modus operandi of the right, which is to use what's called doublespeak. All right, and doublespeak is where you can just say, "War is peace and ignorance is strength." You know, this is the rhetoric has now taken form. But here's the good news. All right, let me tell you the good news. If this was just 70 years ago, the rhetoric of the right would be way more right than you could possibly imagine.
Right.
You'd have jackboots on your fucking neck right now. But
right.
We've all changed. We've all softened. A bit. We're all a bunch of pussies, and that's a good thing. And I hope we become more so. Like, we should just be all the more peaceful. So that's the worst that they can do now and get away with. Create a false reality. At least there no one on like that far side is trying to use jackboots to break unions and to, you know, destroy your rights. They found out that you can do that very subtly over time.
Right. Yeah, they're terrible, man. And I'm not one of these people that thinks that my side of the political spectrum is blameless or flawless.
Did you watch the Democratic Convention when they reintroduced God and Jerusalem to be recognized as the capital of Israel that they had just put in last minute? During the whole thing, they were saying we need 2/3 majority. So they asked for all the yeses and all the noes, which were both equal. And by the end, they're like, the yeses win it by 2/3 majority, and they pass it despite just as much protest for it. So you know what that lesson is? It doesn't matter how fucking hard you yell. It won't matter. They'll just win. That's it. And you saw that. If you go back and you watch that video, you'll see it. It's a depressing moment. I watched it like several times because I'm like, democracy will fail us when it comes to this issue. It will always fail us. Religion does that. That's what it does.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think that's just, you know, worthless rhetoric that they have to throw out there to win an election. I don't see Obama as a very religious person, even though he has certainly pandered to it from time to time.
All right, but let me play devil's advocate, though, right, on this one issue. Let me ask you this. Is it right that under, say, Democrats, they've increased faith-based spending? Actually, they're making it easier to reintroduce themselves. And now these people have money. And now they can defend themselves when we try to go over and say, we don't want that included. They can just easily add it because it won't matter what your voice is. So they have money now. And they have, like, power. How am I supposed to fight this, man? Do we not just find ourselves in a situation where, just like your family, you have to shut the fuck up and just be like, play nice? Isn't that where we are?
I don't know. I think we're just in a position where it's like certainly the free thought community is growing. And it's growing more and more every year. I think the best thing and the only thing we can really do is continue to argue, to continue to sing, to continue to make art that reflects, you know, our ideas.
And continue to come forward, right, about what we actually believe.
Continue to come forward, continue to talk with our friends, continue to just do everything that we're doing now. It's like we are making headway, but any kind of change in the zeitgeist takes time. But I think that we are certainly moving that way. But, you know, when I just think about, like, my own personal thing, for me to go from point A of being a fundamentalist Southern Baptist to being a 30-year-old godless humanist.
Open atheist who comes on, like, shows and talks about it.
Yeah. It took a long time. It took a long time for me to kind of shake that off and find the arguments that debunked it, you know, and to allow myself to believe it, to be convinced of the arguments despite the fact that I so wanted to believe and thought I had so much at stake in believing the other thing. So for us to expect an entire nation to become more and more godless, it's going to take time. And we just have to be patient and diligent.
It's going to be an uphill battle because, I mean, like, even if our voices become 51%, they'll still vote us down. That's what that showed me right there.
Right. But when we become 80%, when we become 90%,
it's going to take a long time to get to that point. You know, I might be an old man by the time that happens, and
we'll
it's going to be no fun for me.
We'll be long dead.
Well, okay, here's the deal. At least you've got to move to Canada because statistics were showing that by 2040, there will be 0% religious belief in Canada. So come on up.
Yeah, that's true. I think all the Canadians that I actually know are atheists. So.
Well, or they don't care. They just are like, well, whatever. We do such a good job at not caring about religion, and that's actually the most powerful weapon against it.
Like, my wife is like that, and I always tell her that, you know, I envy that idea more than anything, like, because even, and I'm certainly a lot better about this now than I was years ago, but even not believing it, I would sit there and wonder about it and think about it all the time, obsess over it because it was so ingrained in me. And I think making this record helped a lot in that, but now I don't care a lot, but she has just never cared, like, could not care if she tried about religion, really. And yeah, I'm like, man, I wish I could be that way. That would be so
freeing.
Like, freeing.
Yeah, that's the big word right there that I'm sure a lot of people, I mean, I can only imagine the type of effort and pressure it just took you to just get off that bandwagon. Like you said before, I mean, there was so much was vested in it. I mean, it is just as traumatic as a gay man coming out.
Depends on where you are. For me, in Austin, Texas, it wasn't that scary of a thing in America.
Well, you know what? You're not black, because coming out as atheist as black is worse. I can guarantee you that.
Yeah, well, I'd imagine, you know, unfortunately, everything is worse.
That's so true.
I'm a middle-class, privileged white man. You know, I don't have a whole lot to fear from anyone.
Privileged middle class, and you now have an exciting kind of deal with Groove Shark, which is sort of like made you popular, crazy fat. Are you shocked by like the growth, by the way?
No, well, we are in Atlanta right now. This is the first night of our tour, and this will be the first time that we kind of get to see how much all our promotions on Groove Shark kind of how much they actually work. So we will see. I mean, it has certainly got us a lot of attention online. We'll see if that translates to real world concert attendance and dollars.
I fucking totally hear you, man. I mean, it is the hardest transition in the world. I remember I went to Reason Rally. Were you like a you must have been non-believer by then, right? At the Reason Rally.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I went to the Reason Rally. And, I mean, I've been doing this thing for 5 years, so I thought, hey, I'm going to announce it, and there's going to be a bunch of people that shows up. Two people. And there were two people that I had already arranged to meet there. I was fucking devastated. It was a harsh lesson about the fucking internet, man. It's like, you could be an internet god, yeah. And you show up, and you're like, hey, dude, I'm big on the internet, and they're like, fuck you.
Yeah, it really is a pretty intangible, immeasurable thing to know if your success online will translate. You just have to go out and actually see if it does. So we'll see tonight at about 11 o'clock, I guess.
Well, you know what? Even if it doesn't, here's the truth. I mean, like, I did watch you guys perform, and I have watched some of your videos and stuff like that. And I think that it is just, it's like that bit of credibility that you guys just need in this, particularly in this new world, you know? It's not like it used to be where some record label just decides to pick you up and then controls every fucking aspect of your life. I mean,
right.
there's a bit freeing to the style that you're doing it. There's more risk in it, but there is, yeah. I think, more reward. And it's just going to take some time. But I think this is definitely one of the big, like, you've got a big notch in your belt as far as I'm concerned. And I think that once people sort of like make that association, that's probably when it's going to start translating. So, because I mean, honestly, your album is good. I enjoyed it. It was very, like I said before, it was energetic, and I did like the contrast between some of your ballads and some of your really energetic choruses. That was just like soft, 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 intense, 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 soft, soft, soft. Sure. So it's like you're playing around with people's you know, emotions here. It's very intense album, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that's what music does, right?
Well, sometimes music does other emotions. Sometimes it's supposed to make you sleepy. I don't think that's
sure.
your music. You know, you do not listen to Quiet Company. That is a lie, sir. You're not quiet in any way.
Yeah, we've been told we're very loud.
This nomenclature cannot stand. You must change your name to Loud Company.
It was. Yeah, the name was a lazy decision on my part, and I probably should have spent a little more time thinking of a new name, but it was a name for a solo thing that I had done in high school, and when my last band broke up, I just went back to it. And
it's a good name, though, man. It's a really good name.
Oh, thank you.
It has a name of, like, you know, once in a while you look at a band name, you're like, seriously? You pick this, and I remember one of your albums was a really simple cover where I think there was like a bunch of lights. There was you in front and a bunch of your bandmates, and it just said Quiet Company. It's not an album cover, or is it? Well, it looks like one.
Just a promo picture, I guess.
All right. Well, that promo picture looked just legit. The writing seemed right. It was just like Quiet Company. I believe this is a band, and you know how it is with music, right? We need to believe. We need to believe that you're real, because you might as well just be a guy with a guitar that shows up on stage, or you're a band. And I'm like, Quiet Company is a band name, dude. I think it's a good, and I love the fact that it's a complete lie.
Yeah, well, it's like, are you a company that is quiet, or are you like a company that manufactures quiet?
Mm-hmm. You understand quiet, because there's none of it around you. You've definitely known everything that leads to non-quietness, making you experts in quiet.
Sure.
That's one way of looking at it. Give me an impression of where you're touring to, so the people who listen can start really following you guys' stuff, because, you know, I'm sure they're like, you've sucked his dick long enough, give us his information. So where are you headed towards? What's your tour?
Well, we're in Atlanta tonight, and we're heading kind of up the East Coast, even though we're not really going to be on the coast, but we're heading up to New York. We're going to do Chattanooga tomorrow, Nashville, Asheville after that, Charlotte, Greensboro, Chapel Hill, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, New York. Then we're going to go home for about a month or so. And then we're going to go back out up to New York for CMJ in October. And then we're going to spend about 2 weeks after that on the road with a band called Brick and Mortar. It's kind of a new, cool band. And we're going to be doing like Chicago and a little bit of the upper Midwest and then back over to the East Coast and then home again. So all that stuff just got announced this week.
Well, there's going to be a link in the notes and on the site. And I'll be sure to also include, if you want to send me links and stuff like that about when you're up, I'll be sure to include those periodically in Facebook if you want to. I mean, it was even funny when I announced that you were coming on the show just a couple of days ago. I even had a few fans who were like, "Hey, I have their album. This is so cool."
Nice.
So I was like, "Hey, all right. Well, I'm glad that I know that the fan base is really going to enjoy your music. And plus, I mean, it is a journey. I mean, they can go back and they can really witness your slow, the slow erosion of your faith until finally sort of like, I guess, almost an appreciation of the secular world in a sense."
Yeah, I like to think of the album as not just me going like, "Oh, well, Christianity isn't real, that sucks," and more about, well, humanism's pretty great, kind of celebratory.
I did a show, actually, on the early history of humanism.
I saw that. I tried to look at it at work, and it wouldn't play on my work computer.
Say what? All right.
I mean,
technical problems. Shit, I gotta fix that.
Well, no, it's not you. It's my work's protection policies or whatever it is, firewalls.
We've got to get this man famous enough so when he says work, he's only producing music, people. So that's the fans who are listening to the show will hopefully like your stuff enough that they will begin to support you, because I think your music's good enough that you should be doing it full-time, dude. I don't like this whole part-time shit. Let's get this guy rolling. And plus, I mean, like I said before, here's what I really like about your music. It's positive, right? Now, although I'm a big jackass and I have long rants about, how shitty religion is, I know that I am not the only game in town, and I need people to sort of like feel a range of emotion. I cannot capture happy. I'm not a happy dude.
If you're going to build a house, you need a lot of different kinds of tools, right?
Shit, yeah. And you represent like an honest and truthful type of happiness. And like I said, I mean, you sounds like you got a great life. Every reason to be appreciative. And, everybody who paints us as these dark, morose motherfuckers,
right?
Like, you're helping to make sure that that's not the image. And I think that that's important. That's why I'm like, listeners, support this man.
I think that it's important to kind of try to maintain that. I mean, we're certainly, none of the guys in the band are morose at all. We're all pretty happy-go-lucky and just enjoy what we're doing. And I think most people that are non-believers are probably that way. At least ways I don't know any that are just walking around depressed as shit all the time.
You might know a few, but, some people are really good at hiding it. And besides, maybe your music cheers them the hell up.
Maybe so.
That is the hope. There is one final question I want to ask before we go. This is something that's sort of been burning in my mind, because I remember that reading that you answer a lot of fan emails, and I have to imagine that a lot of fans have probably made the transition with you. Have you heard a lot of those kinds of stories? Have you sort of like moved people more towards your viewpoint through your music?
I don't know that we have swayed anyone. We've certainly given people the encouragement they need. But that's what, to me, the best thing about music, and the thing that's always made it so magical for me, is it's like everyone has that moment where you're 14 or 15 years old and you're kind of discovering music for the first time. But you're 14, you're 15, so you're kind of an asshole and you think that your problems are the biggest problems in the world.
You're a selfish prick, just like every human being is for a while.
Exactly. You're 14 or 15, and that's just how it is for everyone. But the moment you hear the song or the band that is just the band that you're going to connect with the most, and it doesn't matter what they're singing about, but like the message of the song that you get is that the world is, it's bigger and more beautiful than it has ever been before, and I'm not alone, because this song is proof to me somehow on some weird level that there are others like me that feel the way I feel, that think the things I think, that I'm not strange, I'm not alone. And so this album has been especially, I think, meaningful for people in that way, that kind of need some music to kind of go, oh, but you don't believe in God? That's cool. You know, like,
let's dance.
It's actually pretty, you're better off, trust us, you know.
It's like, holy shit, check out everything else you never knew because your religion stunted your mind growth. It's like, I'm going to fucking blow your mind.
Yeah, it's like, that's, so I mean, I think we get a lot of emails saying how much the record means to them on that level that they just had never had any music to kind of affirm that for them. And it's like, Christian music has a ton of stuff that you can go out and find that, if you want someone to be a cheerleader for the for the things you already think, and we don't really have that much in like any kind of humanist way, and so we were happy to be able to provide that a little bit. I mean, there are some, but
well, you know what? A lot of it was done in the old days, like Renaissance days. Of course, had to mask, they had to put religious imagery on there because that's who was paying the bills. But it was subversive as shit too.
Yeah, but we also get, oddly enough, with the emails, I get a lot of Christian emails from people, and you know, and sometimes they're people that are like, man, I really like your band, I'm just really concerned about your soul now, and
they've joined the bandwagon of people being like, oh, you're gonna burn in hell, and you know what? Every time I hear that, I just want to grab the dude and say, do you realize how morally repugnant that fucking ideology is? Like, just pause for 5 seconds and come on.
It is, but you can't expect them to like think that, and you also kind of have to give them the benefit of the doubt because like they are coming at you from a place of love, like however like fucked up it might be. Like to them, it's like believing the things that they believe, you know, because someone in a place of authority told them, and they wholeheartedly believe it. They genuinely are concerned for you, and they really think this is a fate that they don't want for you. And so it's like you kind of have to, your knee-jerk reaction might be like, no, fuck you, man. I'm not going to hell. Hell's not fucking real. How dare you, you know?
Yeah, but you know how I regard that love? I regard that love the same way that I regard, remember that snowman from Warner Brothers who used to, you know, hug you and pet you a little bit too hard, or like of Mice and Men where it's just like, yeah, exactly. Where it's like, oh, I'm going to crush you to death with my love.
Yeah. But, I mean, and certainly, but at the same time, it's like I always just kind of have to respond with, try to be as kind as possible and be like, well, I really appreciate you writing. And it kind of, at least it opens up a dialogue. And in a dialogue, they have to at least kind of, at least read the words I write and say, at least think about them long enough to read them and allow me to pose questions that maybe they had never allowed themselves to pose. So I enjoy those emails and I get a lot of them. What's really interesting is when the Christians will write me to apologize to me. people I've never met will write and basically just apologize for all of Christianity because surely I've had some terrible experience which has led me to believe or to stop believing and write this album.
And did a priest molest you? I'm so sorry.
Yeah, something like that. And my buddy Todd, I told him that, and he's a Christian, you know, and he was like, well, that's kind of fucked up, you know. How dare they write on my behalf? I'm not apologizing to your ass. And that's pretty funny. But I just have to write them back and be like, no, I actually had very positive experiences in the church. You know, I've never had a terribly negative experience. No one has ever touched me inappropriately or told me I was a bad person. I guess they have done that, but
in a more subtle way, like we're all bad. Yeah. We're all pieces of shit.
No one was ever mean to me or told me I was unwelcome or anything.
What about the threat of hell, though? How did that play out? Like, was it just sort of like something they kind of talked about, like, well, you're probably not going to go there because you're the right religion? Like, it was just not dealt with?
Oh, well, that's definitely dealt with. It's obsessed over, you know. It's Southern Baptist in East Texas. It's a very real, like, physical place that we're going to all burn in, and it's torture forever and stuff. But what's been interesting to me is that since I've become this player in the game, I have a lot of people that I talked with about these things, and it seems that hell is becoming more of a loose idea about, like, it's not torture, it's just separation from God, or some people will say it's that hell is non-existence. Like,
well, there's lots of different religious faiths that have, like, the Jews, for instance, that's what it was, right? Hell was basically you're separated from him, you just disappear. It's pretty much, it sounds actually a lot like real death.
Yeah, I mean, But it's interesting to see that more those ideas coming more from just regular old Christians, not any kind of like Eastern influenced philosophy. Like,
we're all pussies, right? Like, that's the new thing. We're all...
Yeah.
But in the greatest way possible.
Yeah.
We're all just so much nicer. So the threat of hell now, like, it's hard to find anyone who's older than, say, 30 years old that's spewing, like, fiery words of hell. I've actually never met anyone at that age that was actually doing it really well. Like, I think that everybody was like, yeah, it's, what are you talking about? Nah.
Yeah.
That's a big bummer. We don't want to send anybody there. We realize that eternity is a really long time. Like, actually more than,
yeah,
almost more than forever. That's a math joke.
Right. They're like, oh, come on, hell. That's absurd.
You're like, well, what are you talking about? That's like major principles.
We're not going to punish you forever. That's crazy. You know, we'll just punch you for a little while. Well, hey, man, I've actually got to run and get to the venue by 7. So
I appreciate you coming on the show. And like I said before, there's going to be links so that everybody can check out your stuff. And hopefully I'll be able to play one of your songs as the outro. Right? Are you cool with that? Can I play one of your songs as an outro?
Oh, definitely.
All right.
Yeah.
Don't sue me. Don't put me on like DCMR or whatever it's called.
How dare you try to get more people to listen to my music?
I know. I should be fine. All right, Taylor, have a great show. And you know what? Please send me an email to let me know how the whole internet played out in real life.
Will do. Thanks so much, Jacob.
No problem. Have a good day. I burned down heaven and conquered hell. Out you and I should live forever. Cause you and I know how to live. It's you and me. Our love is bigger than most everything. It's stretched out further than our eyes could see. You gave your heart to me complete. Be yeah.